My name's Ben Awney, and I think we'll get started. There are so many new faces in the village that I think I'd like to start this morning the way I did last Monday by telling you a little bit about the person who lives inside this relatively short body. I'm reminded of the importance of this by an incident that occurred from my childhood. I grew up in a small town in western Minnesota. There were 5,000 people, and my father was the superintendent of schools. We had one school building, and everybody from kindergarten to 12th grade went to this one building. We had a sixth grade teacher by the name of Miss Toohey. And I started hearing Miss Toohey stories when I was in first grade about how mean Miss Toohey was. And by second grade, I was hearing stories about how strict Miss Toohey was. And I knew that in a few more years, I might be getting Miss Toohey. By third grade, I was hearing stories about how old she was. And I thought, well, maybe she'll either die or retire before I get there. By fourth grade, how ugly Miss Toohey was. Fifth grade, there was an out, I felt, in that we had increased enrollment and we had to hire a second sixth grade teacher, and it turned out it was a man. And so I went to work on my father, saying I'd had lady teachers all the way through, and I said, you know, Dad, it'd be good for me to have a male role model in sixth grade before I get into junior high. Well, sixth grade came, and you know who I got assigned to, Miss Toohey. And during the year, I found out that all these stories I'd been hearing about her were absolutely correct. She was all of those things. And just one example, every morning we had to put our hands out on the desk, and she'd come along and check our fingernails. And if there was any dirt, out would come the ruler, whack.
Oh dear.
She was very strict, and I thought she was really ugly, and she was mean, and she was old. And the whole year went like that. Well, near the end of school, we had a class picnic, and I remember her herding us all down to the park, and that particular day, she did allow a smile to cross her face, and she played catch, and as I got a little older in junior high, I used to go back and talk with her once in a while, and when I went away to college and later to grad school, I used to come back. You can tell she wasn't that old, because she stayed on many years after I graduated. Over the years, I got to really like the person who lived inside that mean, old, strict, ugly body, and I rather like Miss Toohey. And so if you'll just listen for a little bit, let me tell you a little bit about who I am. During my childhood, early years, I thought it was very important to be good, to be a good boy, to be a good student, to be a good athlete, and I spent a lot of my time and energy being good. And I got to be an expert in those areas. I got to be a very good student. I got to be a very good athlete. I was perceived by my parents and by the church people and by my teachers and by the community as being good. And I don't know why that happened. Maybe it's because in a small town, everybody knows one another, those of you that are from small communities. And maybe it's the position my father had. But whatever the reason, I got very much into creating an image of myself as being a good person, a good boy. I remember that once in a while I'd have angry feelings, but good boys don't get angry, and so I'd stuff those down. Once in a while I'd feel sad and about something, and but I'd never let that come out because good boys don't cry, and so I'd stuff those feelings down. Once in a while I'd have other evil thoughts that were kind of exciting, but good boys don't have those thoughts, so I'd stuff those down. And so through all my early years in Breckenridge, till I graduated, and on into college and on into grad school, I continued to cultivate this image of being good. And that carried over into achieving and trying to be the best student, athlete, whatever it was that I could possibly be. I did have a few weaknesses. One I'll share with you was that I loved candy and sweets. Any of you like that? And I remember reading once that if you eat enough of a certain type of food, you'll get sick from it, and then you won't want to see it again. It's kind of aversion training your behavior mind. So I decided to try out that theory. I went down to the candy store, I suppose I was fourth, fifth grade, and bought all the candy I could afford. And at that point, you know, candy bars were just a nickel, so you could get quite a lot for a dollar, whatever I had. And I ate and ate till I really did, in fact, get sick. But a couple days later, I was back at the candy store, and I've snuck over to the snack bar a couple times, and you know, I still have a real sweet tooth, but I've learned how to control it a little bit. Well, about 11 years ago, I got married, and you may be interested to hear my technique in proposing. My wife and I were attending a retreat, and well, we weren't married at the time, but we were both at a retreat, and it was very late one night, so I knew she'd be vulnerable. It was about 1 o'clock. She wanted to go to bed, and I said, I got a few more things I want to talk to you about. And so I said, this is my technique now, I said, if I asked you to marry me, what would you say?
No risk.
And she said, I think I'd say yes. I said, okay, will you marry me? And she was vulnerable, wanted to get to bed, so she said yes. And so we were married. And after about 2 years, it was time to have a child. And I remember ordering a blue-eyed, blonde-haired boy. I wanted him to be good-looking and slightly above-average intelligence. And I also whispered, I hope you like sports. And after a while, Nathan was born. And you've seen him running around here. And he is all those things. After 7 weeks, though, he was sick quite often when he was a young baby. And we discovered that he had congenital malaria. My wife and I had just spent 2 years in New Guinea teaching. And when we came back to the States, we went up to Effie, Minnesota, which is way up in northern Minnesota, has a population of about 90 during the tourist season. And so congenital malaria of any sort, was very, very rare there. And we had to rush him down to the University of Minnesota Hospital. And for a while, it was really touch and go. And they flew people up from Atlanta, the Center for Disease Control, to try to break down the treatment, the tablet, in a small enough dose so that it would eradicate the parasite, but not kill him. And so I remember whispering, you know, he doesn't have to like sports, and somehow God looked over him, and you know, he did pull through. After a couple of years, we decided to order a girl to match, and something went wrong with this order. After about 5 months, my wife had a miscarriage, about 6 months, and it was a little girl, actually, but she had a miscarriage. We weren't together at the time. I was going to grad school down in Minneapolis, and she was staying with her parents up in Bemidji. I remember the phone call. My wife was crying, and she said, I've lost the baby, and please come up right away. And so I just took off. I hopped in the car and took off and drove very fast. Got there in record time. I went in, and I remember going down the hospital and seeing the nurses and how's everything, and then going into the hospital room where my wife was, and when I walked in, she saw me and broke into tears. And you know what I said? I said, "Don't cry, it's all right." And many months later, when we could talk about it, she said that was the worst thing you could say to me. And you know why I said it? Because good boys don't cry. I'm here, I'll take care of things. And it was this, you know, image thing that I'd been into, and I didn't allow myself to get into the pain and the hurt that was there, that I surely was experiencing too, but I'd stuffed it so down that I was going to come down and make everything right. And even to this day, I've not allowed myself to cry. I've come close, but I've not really dealt with that. Well, the doctor said, you know, what you have to do is have another child right away. And so we did. We worked on it, and we're successful. And about 12, 13 months later, Luke was born. Some of you have seen Luke running around. He's right now in transition between his terrible twos and being a three-year-old. He's into everything. I brought along the Valentine that my oldest boy, Nathan, wrote in school last year, which I think will explain Luke. Nathan wrote, I love my mom and dad.
because I get my brother out of my room.
So that's Luke. You'll hear him and see him running around.
I think one other thing I'll share from my background, that occurred about 2 years ago now. I was in training for chemical dependency counseling, and I was at the Johnson Institute. They have a 3-week summer training school. And as part of that training, we go through a very intensive 2-day marathon where, with a group of 10 or 12 people, you're put in a room and you just deal with a lot of things. Well, I got put with some real interesting characters. I'll just tell you about a couple of them real quickly. One fellow was a former hitman for the mafia, and he had a similar goal as mine, which was to cry. Another fellow was an alcoholic, a chain smoker, a heroin addict, who had quit cold turkey, former Hell's Angel, divorced. He was in there. We had a gal who had been involved in incest when she was very young, another lady that had been raped. Most of the people in there were recovering alcoholics or still alcoholic, and then there was me. I thought, my goodness, what am I doing with this cast of characters? And they picked that up right away. And in fact, the first day I just played it cool. I sat back and let them cry and get out their hurt and their anger and watched them do their thing. And I sat back and just observed all of this. And the second day they jumped all over me, said, "What do you think you are, some sort of saint? Do you think you're better than we are?" And I had to confess, yes, I do. Because I haven't done all these things that you've done. And so for the next 3 or 4 hours, we dealt with me. And I did cry. I did get angry. I got out a lot of feelings that I'd been stuffing for 31 years. And I connected up with those people. I could see how we were very similar in many ways. And at the end, they said, "Welcome back to the human race." And it was a very cleansing experience for me. I'm not chemically dependent, never have been. I'm not an alcoholic or recovering alcoholic, but I owe a lot to those people because I feel that I'm a recovering human being, getting more in touch with my feelings. And it's a day-by-day type of thing. And a lot of the issues and spirituality that recovering alcoholics, chemically dependent people have to deal with day-by-day, I think, all of us have to deal with. And I want to share some of that during the week as we talk about dependencies. Well, is there anything else you'd like to know about me before we start?
I do.
Okay.
You talked the other day when you were talking about goals and the things that you've been doing and the different jobs that you've held and those kind of things. What are your goals now?
Well, I want to be in an occupation where I can be challenged and feel that I'm contributing something and towards my own growth and towards the growth of other people. I want to spend time with my family and for my own recreation and enjoyment. I also, and one reason I came to Holden is I want very much to tie into God's creation and his plan for his creation, for his people, and to be a part of carrying the cross and being a witness. Okay. Well, my task this week is to talk about dependencies, primarily chemical dependency, and to offer advice. Have any of you ever given advice? Have any of you ever violated the advice you've given? It's kind of risky, isn't it? And I can sit up here, stand up here, and take responsibility for every word that I say to you, but I don't know what you're hearing. Picture this, if you will. Kathy Hansen is a young girl, about 6, and whenever she meets new people, she likes to say, "I'm Dr. Hansen's daughter, Kathy," or "I'm Kathy Hansen, the doctor's daughter." And her mother took her aside one day and said, "Kathy, when you meet people, just say you're Kathy, you're Kathy Hansen. You don't always have to say you're you're Dr. Hansen's daughter. Because she felt that, you know, as we understand, Kathy was just trying to get a little extra pull with her people she was meeting. Well, it so happened the next day there was a substitute teacher at school. And as the teacher looked out over the rows of children, her eyes fell upon Kathy. She walked over and said, "Aren't you Dr. Hansen's daughter, Kathy?" And Kathy looked up and said, "I always thought I was until last night." And so I don't think that's what Mother meant, but that's what Kathy heard. And likewise, there may be some things that I say that I know what I'm saying, but you may hear it a little differently. And so I'd like to invite you at any of the sessions, if you know, to just feel free to jump in, and I like to have a lot of interaction, not just straight lecture. Well, you know a little bit about who I am. You know why I'm here. I think there's only one other thing we have to cover before I get into the topic, and that is to try to arrive at some common ground, some things that we all believe in, so we have a mutual starting point. Does that seem to make sense? Let me tell you three things that I believe, and I'd like you to raise your hand if you too believe in them. One is that I believe life is a precious gift. How many of you believe that? We believe that, but often we forget, don't we? I remember when I was small, I broke something of my mother's, and she didn't talk to me in a manner that made me feel that I was a precious gift. In fact, I felt that that vase was more important than I was. We got a new car about a year and a half ago, and it cost a lot of money, and I remember getting a call at school from my wife. She wasn't crying, but I could tell she's upset. She said, "I was just in an accident." You know what my first response was?
Car.
Oh, it's the car. Erich Fromm has written, you know, the pity in life is that most of us die before we're fully born. And we often fail to appreciate that life is a gift and that all of us are precious. There's a story that I've heard Al Rognes preach about, and it captures for me some of this sense of life as a precious gift. There was a boy, a 7 or 8 year old boy, who was dying of a disease that affected the bones, the bone marrow. The only way to save him was to take some of this marrow from his sister. And if they didn't do that, the boy would die, for sure. And so the parents understood this, and they took aside the younger sister, I think she's only 5 or so, and tried as best they could to explain that her brother needed an operation so he wouldn't die, and that she would have to participate by having some of her bone marrow taken. Well, the little girl said, "Okay, I'll do that." And the operation took place, it was successful, and the boy recovered. And the parents, when they went in to see the girl, when she was coming out of the being under, the little girl looked up and said, "When am I going to die?" Because she had thought that she had misunderstood what this was all about, and she thought that she would have to die so that her brother could live. I think, you know, that captures in a very beautiful way that life is a gift, and we are all precious. And this gets into the second thing that I believe in, that we're all unique and precious human beings. How many of you agree with that? We're all unique and special. It was mentioned in one of the Vesper services that there never has been, and there never will be, someone exactly like you or like me. We all have different fingerprints, and our backgrounds and our future, our hopes and dreams are different. And that, to me, is important, because a lot of us, just like me when I was growing up, I wanted to be good, I wanted to be accepted, I wanted to be like everybody else. A lot of us forget that we're unique and special. We were created that way. There's a reason for that. We don't have to be like everybody else. And yet, if we become too unique, what happens? Society comes along and sticks a label on us, don't they? And so it's kind of a tension between being accepted, being part of the community, and asserting our own uniqueness and personhood. Often at Holden Village, I know that last week this happened, people wanted to know what I did. Who are you? And once they knew my job, then they had me picked, then they had me labeled. And then they knew how to relate to me. I was asked, am I a doctor? Am I a pastor? Am I a teacher? Am I a counselor? What in the world are you anyway? Because they wanted to know. And some of it is just curiosity and conversation. I realize that. But we all have a tendency to label people according to what they do. And you may know about all my degrees and where I went to school and what I'm doing, but you know nothing about me. And same with you. That means nothing where I went to school. It means nothing what I'm doing right now. That is not me. That's just a job I'm involved in. Okay, the third thing I believe in is that we can change and change for the better. How many of you agree with that? Okay. Change is an interesting phenomenon. I'd like to invite you to do an experiment with me. Would all of you fold your hands, please? Okay, how many of you have your right thumb on top of your left thumb? Okay, you don't get any points for that. I was just curious. Okay, now what I'd like you to do is to switch hands. Put your other thumb on top of the other hand. How does that feel? Not good. Okay. It feels uncomfortable, doesn't it? Okay, now shake your hand. Okay, now fold your hands again. How many of you went back to your original position? All of us, right? Why do we do that? Because it's comfortable. Change is not comfortable. We can all change, and we can all change for the better, but a lot of us don't change for the better because it's not comfortable. It involves risks, and it might be uncomfortable. Another experiment. Fold your arms. Okay, some of you have this hand on top. No, what I'd like you to do is to reverse it. The hand is under prayer. You getting it? How many of you had trouble with that? Okay. Now, there's one easy way to do it, and that is just to not change everything. I mean, if you start going like this, you really, you know, get all mixed up. But just keep an anchor point with one arm and just bring the other one around. And that's the way it is with change, too. When you want to change, don't try to change everything all at once. You have to keep some beliefs, some values, some foundation as you change the rest of your personality, whatever it is you're changing. So I think while we can change and change for the better, a lot of us don't because it isn't comfortable, and change involves risks and conflict. And secondly, if we do change, we try to change too much all at once. Okay, well, let me get into why I'm here, what I want to talk about, and why you came to this topic. Dependency is right now a dirty word. It started, I guess, during the 70s when a lot of chemical dependency programs got started. Now, of course, there are some dependencies that are necessary, like air and food and water and shelter and people. These are all dependencies that we need. But there are a lot of excessive, unnecessary dependencies that we choose, it's voluntary, that we choose to get involved with that can limit our personhood, that can cause hurt and pain, and are just simply not healthy and truly dangerous. What might be some of these dependencies? Let me just put a couple on the board.
Coffee.
Okay.
Drugs.
Others.
Alcohol. It's considered a drug, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Smoking.
Okay.
Sleep. Candy.
Food.
Okay, food.
Well, that's
what. Interesting with food. Food, I was going to talk about it later in the week, as overindulgence being a dependency, that often instead of dealing with something, we'll go and eat. If we're experiencing a lot of tension or having a bad relationship, instead of dealing with it, we'll go eat. But also on the other end, I just found out that anorexia, where people don't eat, is considered substance abuse. And someone with anorexia is treated in a chemical dependency program. And I didn't know that till last night. So food, both overindulgence and not eating, substance abuse, food being the substance. Okay, any other dependencies that you can think of?
Certain relationships.
Okay.
How about work?
Sure. Work.
Schedules?
Adulation?
Approval?
Okay, yeah, approval.
Some people use travel as a...
Okay. Well, there are a lot of dependencies that can be harmful. Some things are very necessary, some things are not. What I'd like to focus on today and tomorrow, and even on into Wednesday, are chemical dependencies. But to start with, I'm going to talk about relationships in general, because I think the key to understanding chemical dependency is to realize that it's a sick, pathological relationship. Despite everything else chemical dependency is, whether it's alcohol or certain drugs, at the bottom, it's a relational issue. And you can't work on chemical dependency prevention or treatment until you understand that it's a relationship. So today I want to make sure that we all understand this very basic fact that of chemical dependency being a sick, pathological relationship. First, some comments on relationships. And some of these other dependencies we'll get to during the week. I'd like you to consider relationships in three ways. Relationships as windows. This represents you, me, and this is our universe. And in our universe, we have relationships with a lot of different people. Some of these people, the relationship is very important and is very close to the center. For others, they're way out. For some, we've created walls or they've created walls. But think for just a second on relationships as windows, walls, or bridges. One kind of looking is, and seeing, honestly and caring, is like putting windows into lives where there aren't any. Another way to look at relationships is to break through the layers of doubt and suspicion that often separate us from other people, like tearing down walls. And the third kind is making connections with people, like bridges. Have any of you ever been in a room where there weren't any windows? Okay. Or gone by a room that, you know, you're on the outside and it was all boarded up? Okay, if you've had that experience, both being in a room without any windows or seeing a room without that's all boarded up, there's a curiosity, I think, to want to know what's on the other side. Okay? And each of us, in a sense, is like the room. And until we open our windows, pull up our shades, you don't know me and I don't know you. And that's one reason I always like to start a week or a talk by sharing a little bit about me, by becoming somewhat vulnerable, by lifting up the shade a little bit, by opening the window a little bit, because I realize in giving, I will receive. And if I can risk and share a little bit of myself, you may do the same, and some neat things may happen as we get to know one another today and during the week. If I don't open up the windows, you aren't going to do so either. And so there's a jealous reason behind it, that I know that in giving, I'll receive. In opening my window, you may open your window, and we'll be able to connect up eventually. Okay. When people use drugs or when they get hurt or confused, they often go into a room with no window. Think about that. When people are using drugs, they get hurt or they're confused, it's like going into a room, closing the doors, boarding up the windows, and there they are. And quite often, the people on the other side, they pull down the shades too, because they don't want to deal with this person that's using the drugs or in their own room. And so it's working on both ends. And what often happens is that this retreat becomes like prison. And then we get into the second type of relationship, breaking down walls. People build walls because they want to keep something in or keep something out. And for some people, using drugs is the way of building walls. To keep out the world, to hide behind, they feel safe, they feel protected if they can build a wall by use of drugs. But pretty soon, the walls that were supposed to keep the world out, or the parents off their back, or the teachers from hassling them, become their own set of prisons. I want to invite you to do a brief exercise here. There are two fellows that have done a thing, I guess dealing with windows and walls. It's called the Johari window. And the two men were Joe and Harry, and they came up with this scheme, so they call it the Johari window. Any of you ever done this or heard about it before? Johari window? Okay. The self and others, this has to do with relationships now. There are some areas about me and about you that are open. It's open information. You know now that I like candy. Okay, it's open. I've revealed it. There are some things that are not revealed to you, but I know about them. These are secrets. I haven't told you everything about me. There's still things that are secrets. I know you don't know. That's blocked off. There's a wall between me and you. Now there are some things that you know about me that I may not know. This is sort of blocked out too. And these are things that I'm blind to as I stand up here. Now if I have a little chalk on my nose, you know that, I don't know that. You know, just a real simple little illustration. Until afterwards I go check in your, oh my gosh, I had a chalk on my nose, I don't think, no one told me. Okay, and then the last one is kind of the unconscious, which is unknown to me largely and unknown to other people. Now any relationship is built on these four sets of communications, if you will. What I'd like you to do, real quick, is to think of one secret that you have, one thing about you that the person next to you maybe doesn't know. You don't have to check a, go a spouse, you can turn the other way. And I'd like you to share one secret about yourself. Now you're not going to see a lot of these people after you leave here, so here's your chance to, you know, to come up with a real nice secret. You've always wanted to tell someone, but you can't where you live because, you know, it'd get around. But here you could share it, okay? Just one secret. How many of you have your secret in mind? I don't want you to take too much time. Think of one thing. Now, it doesn't have to be anything, you know, real. Because the person next to you doesn't know anything about you, almost anything you say is going to be a secret, right? Okay? So just share one thing with your neighbor here. I'll explain what happens to this window when you do that. Okay? You don't have to whisper. Yeah, you open this up, you took a little bit from your secret life, and your open area got bigger, right? So it's like this moved over to here in sharing. Some of what was blind became open, and so your window changed from being a nice little square to being somewhat bigger. Now, someone that has a healthy relationship generally has a very big open area. There are secrets that, you know, there are some things that we just
want to keep to ourselves. There's nothing wrong with that. But there are some people that are so drawn into themselves that the open area is very, very small, and the secret area is very big. And the more withdrawn you get, the more you build walls and pull shades and shut windows and don't make bridges, the more you become like that, the more shriveled up you become, the more unhealthy you become in terms of relationships. That's extremely important to understand when we're looking at chemicals. The more you can be open with other people, the more you can share some of your secrets or some of your needs, the more healthy you become. And you also get a little side benefit here in that you get in touch with seeing with the third eye, or getting in touch with some part of spirituality or some of the unconscious aspects that we often don't deal with. Okay, so you have to kind of assess yourself what your window looks like. Can people see into you? Are you able to see into other people? And the neat thing about relationships, I guess, is that if you open your window a little bit, what does the other person do? He can see in, and often he'll raise his window a little bit. And that's the whole basis of meaningful relationships. You can't have a relationship if you have walls between yourself and the other person, or if the shades are pulled, or if you don't have a bridge connecting.
I have a question, though, because I found, at least with myself, that maybe I'm a little too open, I'm not really sure. That sometimes frightens people, I think. And then, or maybe the problem is that maybe most people can't open themselves up as much as I can, but then I get bad feedback, and which closes me back up and think, oh, you big mouth, you bad person, you shouldn't have been, you know, so honest or open about yourself. Not what I'm saying, this is in context of being, just revealing myself, not opinionating or whatever else, this is just, so then it makes you close up and not quite so sure about yourself.
That's unfortunate, and I would agree that so many of us have grown up pulling shades and building walls, and when we do meet someone that truly is open, it's very hard to relate to that person. It takes a long time, and you have to be sensitive to people that aren't as open to you.
But then but it does, you know, it's kind of a thing, how do you fight this, you know, I'm different, you know, feeling, you know, you can see, well, they don't do that, you know, what is it that I look like, you know, and you don't think then that you're healthy, you think that they're healthy.
A lot of what you get when you dare to, you know, be open like that is a lot of what you talked about, don't cry, the same kind of thing, because I had an experience recently that I, you know, had an aunt and uncle I hadn't seen for a long, long time, some cousins, and told them that when I was young and still inside of me, I felt like a very shy person, and they laughed, you know, because they didn't see me as shy, and so they deny that feeling in a way that you have inside of you. And I think that's what happens so often when you tell somebody something that you feel inside of you or something you have going, and they say, oh, you shouldn't feel that way.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you and then you.
I have the same feeling that Becky gets sometimes. And when I was in college, there was a book that everybody was reading, which was Why Am I Afraid to Tell People Who I Am? And I was feeling rather strange because everybody else was saying, yeah, why am I afraid? And I was feeling, well, if I don't tell people who I am, they'll get the wrong impression, and they might not get the same impression of me that I want them to get. So my feeling was, you know, why am I afraid to keep secrets?
Sure. And the answer to that question posed in the book was what? Why are people afraid to tell others who they are?
Because you might not like the person.
Because people might not like who they see. They might not like me. Yeah.
As in, my name's Becky. I'm Melanie. And I have that same problem because a lot of people tell me that I open their windows for them because I'll share almost anything about myself. But a negative effect, side effect of that is that I have great expectations of people whom I encounter, and I expect them give me back everything I'm giving them, and half the time I feel really slighted because they they don't do that, and I learned so little from other people.
Yeah.
And then you've given away everything you are, you know, and you don't have any secrets or anything.
I always like the illustration in the book that I read about, you know, we can be friends and a lot of times it'll be just sort of a nice kind of friendship. But in everybody's life there's a can of worms, and it's going beyond that can of worms and keeping the person as friend, being able to expose and yet knowing that person is still going to be there.
Yeah. That's what I experienced in that marathon,
yeah.
That I was really afraid to let those people see who I was. And so for 30-some years, I developed an image of myself, and a lot of people thought that was a very phony image, and I thought it was the way to be. And they cut through that, and I was able to reveal myself and find that they still did care about me, and they still accepted me, and it was just really a tremendous release. And I think it's a similar type of acceptance that Christians talk about when they're accepted by God, despite their sinful nature. You are accepted, and that's a tremendous source of hope and faith and assurance. And when we can really feel that in our lives, then it doesn't matter. Then we can risk. We can be open. We can be vulnerable. But when we forget that, then we do want to draw in. We forget that we're all broken people, and that we all yearn for healthy, meaningful, wholesome relationships, but often we're unable to do that. And you see, that's why a lot of people turn to drugs. Because drugs do work. You can have a meaningful love relationship with a mood-altering chemical that makes you feel better, it takes away a lot of problems, you can trust it, it's available, it's there, it doesn't disappoint you. And someone who is chemically dependent has a love relationship with a mood-altering chemical. And that relationship becomes more important than the relationship with people, whether it's a spouse or children or boss. The relationship with mood-altering chemical is the most important relationship. And we'll get into that right now. I wanted to read one quote from a former addict that relates to some of the comments that were just made. I want you to realize my strengths and not be intimidated by them, my weaknesses and understand their roots. I want to gain strength from your strengths and offer hope from you despair. I'd like to see the world through your eyes and open for you new doors of perception. There's so much for us to share, so much for us to learn. All it will take is for each of us to accept one more friend. And people who have gotten past drugs are ready to help build bridges. They want the contact. They want to be tied back into a network of living, breathing, doing people. But they can't do it on their own. They can construct the bridge halfway. But it takes the rest of us, those of us who aren't alcoholics or dependent on drugs, to also reach out and make the connections with people. Just as I did in that marathon, I was able to connect up with those people and see our common humanness. I think all of us also have to connect up with people in our community, people in our church who are hurting, who are broken, and develop relationships with them too. Because I think too often, we like to pull the shades on those people. We like to construct walls with those people. And that can be very unhealthy for them as well as for us. Part of being normal and healthy is wanting new relationships, new adventures, new joys. And we find relationships on three levels. And the topic today was on people, things, and chemicals, and I'm just now finally getting to it. But I'd like you, on a sheet of paper, to draw three relationship maps. And on the first one, we've been talking about this. We all have relationships with other people.
with a spouse, with children, with our own parents, with relatives, with the boss, employees, people at church. We all have people-to-people relationships. And on your paper, what I'd like you to do is very quickly write down people that come to mind in your relationship map. Don't put a lot of time in it, because I want people that come, you know, first of all to your mind, because these are the people you carry with you. These are the relationships that are important. The more important the person is to you, or that relationship is to you, I'd like you to write it in close to the center, close to you. If you have a relationship with someone that isn't quite as important, put them out a little farther from the center. And I'll only give you about a minute to do this, so you have to work quickly. But what I'm asking you to do is to put down relationships you have with people that you feel are important and fairly meaningful and significant right now in your life. Specific people you want to name. I've done this with some kids, and they can't come up with more than five. I mean, they really have to think, and that's sad. And other people, just flows out. Okay. Now, I'm going to tell you what I want you to do in the second one, too. We also have relationships with things, with job, with community, with hobbies, with nature, with pets, with possessions. What are some important relationships you have with things right now in your life? If a thief were to break into your house and take some of your things, what would you feel most upset about him walking off with? Or if you couldn't go to your lake cabin, would that upset you very much? I mean, what are the relationships you have, person, you in the center, to things? The same thing. The more important the thing is to you, write it in closer or write it bigger. If it's a relationship but it's not as important, write it out on the end or out farther into your universe. And the same strict time limit. Only a minute or so. Relationships with, I'm going to say MAC, which stands for mood altering chemicals. And I'd like you in the third circle to write down any relationship you've ever had or currently have with a mood altering chemical. Now, some relationships are necessary and legitimate. A doctor's prescribed certain pills which alter your mood, but you're supposed to do this. But, you know, beer, or rum, or gin, nicotine, caffeine, I think we'll leave out sugar because it's very hard to escape that mood-altering chemical. But believe me, it is a mood-altering chemical. It does stimulate you, and after 1 or 2 hours, you do come down. You do get depressed or tired or drowsy. It is a mood-altering chemical, sugar is, and maybe one of the most dangerous in our society, but it's so pervasive I won't have you put it down, unless you want. Any mood-altering chemical that you've had, put in here. If it's a very strong relationship, you can't start out the morning without a cup of coffee, you'd have to put caffeine very close. Or if you smoke, chain smoke, nicotine can be very important to you. If you tried pot once, it didn't do anything for you, you put marijuana way out on the edge, or whatever. If you like to have a beer, or let's say a cocktail at the end of every day, you'd put your gin and tonic in here, because that must be a fairly important relationship. It's something you look forward to every day after work. Or if you have to take a sleeping pill to go to sleep every night, that's a fairly significant relationship. Or if you have to take other pills to stimulate you, certain amphetamines, that's a fairly significant relationship.
What about occasional aspirin?
Occasionally, you know, you put it way out. There is a relationship there, but it's casual, it's not that significant.
But it can be in the mind.
It can, yes, it can be. Mm-hmm. And later we'll get into actual physical dependency as well as psychological dependency. If every time you go on a trip you have to bring along sleeping pills because you feel when you travel you can't sleep normally, then you have a relationship with these sleeping pills. Okay. I know I haven't given you a whole lot of time, but I want to get to my final point, which is the purpose of this, what we've been leading up to. And that is that in a healthy person, they have... Well, which one of these three is most significant for someone that's healthy?
The top one.
The top one, right? This relationship map is generally fairly large, and you have a lot of relationships. Now, if you only have one relationship, and you blot out everything else, that can be a very sick relationship. You can be an unhealthy person. So, in your person-to-person map, you want to cultivate a lot of relationships. A healthy, normally functioning person has a lot of meaningful relationships with other people. You don't just have one or two. Agreed? Okay. We also have important relationships with things. And there's nothing wrong with that unless that's where all our treasure is, unless that's more important than people, unless it gets in our way. And for a lot of people it does. We get all caught up in materialistic possessions. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with having meaningful relationships with our hobbies or with, you know, job or church or whatever the things are you put down in your maps. And here again, if we had more time, I'd have you share among one another and notice similarities and differences and open up windows between you, but we don't. For many of you, this relationship is less significant, but we live in a chemically using society. In no way do any of you have blank maps there. I know, because we all use chemicals. And there's nothing wrong with using chemicals. They're there for our good and betterment. The problem is a lot of people misuse, abuse, and become dependent. Tomorrow I'll go into those terms and talk about how you can get dependent. Chemical use is not bad. When a doctor tells me to take these tablets, it's chemical use, it's prescribed, it's legitimate, it's not bad. It's when you misuse it and abuse it that we run into problems. Now, what do you think the relationship map for a chemically dependent person looks like? People don't need them. They're just a big hassle. In fact, the only relationships with people are people that are using. Because they don't put you down, they don't threaten you, they don't get on your case, and all the other things you hear people saying. So the relationships are drinking buddies, peer-using friends, the bartender. These are the relationships that are important for someone who's dependent. Things don't have hobbies. I don't go to church. I've gone through 5 jobs. I've had to hawk my TV set. Things are not important to someone who's dependent on chemicals. The most important relationship in the world is this one. They will do anything. They'll lie, cheat, steal to keep that relationship alive. They'll get a divorce. They'll lose jobs to keep that relationship alive. That is the love relationship. Because This one works every time. If you're feeling down, this one will make you feel better. If these people are on your back, this won't get on your back. Do you see what happens with someone who becomes dependent? That's why the key essence of chemical dependency is a sick, unhealthy relationship with Mac. That's what chemical dependency is. And there's no way you're going to attack the problem or understand the problem until you understand that basic point. That chemical dependency, alcoholism, pot smoking, whatever you want to call it, is a relationship issue. People that have meaningful relations up here don't need this. They don't need this. People that don't have any meaningful relationships that need this. And the tragedy is that as you get into this, you start building walls, you start pulling shades, and the people that could help you most also start building walls and pulling shades. And so someone can get caught in here and can die. There are 10 million alcoholics, there are 30 million people hooked on Valium. People are dying in car accidents because they drink too much. People are dying from this unhealthy relationship. The tragedy of it is that most of us don't do anything about it. We don't want to be around these people.